What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Many of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, which is my effort to find the most interesting and sit with them for hours while I ask questions in an effort to learn. So it would mean the world to me if you would subscribe to the show on your favorite audio platform, watch episodes on YouTube, and tell your friends and family about the podcast. My goal is to help millions learn from the world's most interesting people. So let's get into today's episode.
Today's episode is with Jahan Bose-Little. He's the co-founder and managing partner at Bracket Capital, an investment firm focused on special situation opportunities in growth and late-stage private companies. In this conversation, we talk about the similarities and differences between investing in Coinbase, SpaceX, Stripe, and many other companies. We also talk about Bitcoin, the landscape of private markets, financialization of venture capital, how the investing trends and sectors that they're focused on have shaped many of the outcomes, and also crossover investment examples going from the private market to the public market, how they're thinking about market liquidity, and much, much more. I really enjoyed this conversation with Jahan. He's a great friend of mine and someone I've learned a ton from, and I'm excited for you all to listen to our conversation. Here's my episode with Jahan Bose-Little.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Today's episode is brought to you by Meanwhile. Meanwhile is the world's first licensed and regulated life insurance company built for the Bitcoin economy. Operating on the Bitcoin standard, they do everything in Bitcoin. You pay in Bitcoin. They pay claims to your family in Bitcoin. You take out policy loans entirely in Bitcoin when you need liquidity. Meanwhile, Bitcoin life insurance has redefined what it means to HODL. Protect your family from life's uncertainty and a broken financial system. Build intergenerational Bitcoin wealth while the cost of living skyrockets in dollar terms. Get all the tax and legal benefits of life insurance now in Bitcoin. They are actively binding policies today. Whether you are a long-term Bitcoiner or are just considering it for the first time, a Bitcoin whole life policy could make sense for your wealth plan. Visit their website, meanwhile.bm, to join the waitlist and to learn more about the world's first Bitcoin life insurer. Again, that's meanwhile.bm. Go check them out today. Today's episode is brought to you by Supra. They just launched a brand new $1 million Bitcoin DeFi accelerator dedicated to Bitcoin L2 ecosystem dApps. Bitcoin builders, you can integrate with Supra's price feeds into your dApps and apply for the accelerator at supra.com/pomp-btc. Again, that's supra.com/pomp-btc. It's open for a limited time, so get moving ASAP. By the way, the program includes free access to Supra's price feeds with 600 to 900 millisecond data refreshness and next-gen accuracy, as well as low-latency verifiable randomness, both serving over 55 blockchains, including Bitcoin L2s. With these powerful services and the $1 million Bitcoin DeFi accelerator, Supra is going all in on the Bitcoin ecosystem. Here's something extra if you're not a builder. You can earn $1,500 by referring Bitcoin L2 projects to apply to the $1 million Bitcoin DeFi accelerator. Their projects can get financial support, and you bag $1,500 for every referral. Join Supra affiliates and spread the word. You can go to supra.com/pomp-btc to learn more. That's supra.com/pomp-btc. Go check them out today.
All right, guys. Bang, bang. We got Jahan here. I thought a great place to start this conversation is you and I both invested in Coinbase in some of the later days of it being a private company. It went public. You guys made a lot of money. So why'd you guys like Coinbase, and kind of talk a little bit maybe in terms of like the strategy of entering a company like that with a shorter time horizon to liquidity?
Yeah. Thanks. Yes. Coinbase was really emblematic of a lot of stuff that we were doing back in that sort of, 2017-18 time, as in we were really looking for category leading companies. Coinbase was and is, the category leader in that space, obviously. We put a lot of thought in that time into whether it made sense to own the equity of a business like Coinbase, or whether you would just outperform owning the tokens. We opted for doing both. So, we managed some money in Bitcoin and Ethereum as well at that time. But Coinbase was a great returner. There was a lot of early employees and early investors in that business. If you rewind even 6 to 12 months before the IPO, the business was trading around $6 or $7 billion in value. I think it's roughly 50 now, but it peaked at close to 100 at the time. And it really wasn't clear to the market how big this business could be. The bear case was it's a brokerage. You know, brokerages trade on relatively low multiples, right? The bear case was that it was going to be the center, you know, the center of gravity and the nucleus for the entire crypto ecosystem, right? And would expand into many of the areas that it's expanded into now. And so we were able to buy some shares from some early investors via the secondary market at around, you know, $6 billion. Turned out to be about 6 months before the IPO, right? You know, and it was at 90 in no time. So we've done a lot of stuff on the secondary market. I think Coinbase over time, you know, roughly speaking, has been a similar investment to just owning some of the majors. And so it's really just a question of tactics, right? Obviously, there's never a chance to have Bitcoin or Ethereum trading at a large discount to where the rest of the market would see it, or at a large premium. And so I think that's sometimes some of the value that equities give you when you're thinking about crypto is that, you know, they can be very richly valued at times or very undervalued. Whereas the liquidity of the tokens themselves, you know, keeps them much more efficiently priced.
Now, you and I have known each other for a while, and I think one of the things that I've always appreciated is that you guys are industry agnostic, but there does seem to be some kind of core themes and you know, there's innovation, there's kind of tech infused into this stuff. And so Coinbase being kind of one great example in the Bitcoin and crypto ecosystem, but another company like SpaceX, right, where you guys seem to have this kind of, you know, medium to long-term view as to that company and kind of being the category creator. Talk about SpaceX and kind of how you all got comfortable allocating there.
Yeah, SpaceX has been one of our largest investments and still is since 2017 when we founded the firm. So, you know, it's been private over 20 years now. SpaceX is, I guess, the real definition of a category leader and an N of one company, right? Although Coinbase, you know, is very similar in that respect, but, you know, clearly SpaceX is a veritable monopoly at this point. I think that what we like to try and do is, as you say, be open-minded to investing in things that have venture-like returns. We find that those things often happen in sort of, you know, innovative areas. It could be somebody with a lead extending that lead. It could be somebody doing something like SpaceX, which, you know, which the world thought was impossible, right? And investing at an inflection point when you see some possibility and the market may not be pricing in that possibility. And so, you know, with respect to SpaceX, it's been interesting to see the evolution of that business. You know, we certainly weren't one of the earliest investors, but our first investment was around $20 billion or so. You know, this is 2017. And so that was post-reusable rockets, but far before Starlink rolled out, right? And the way we were thinking about the business back then was there was sort of three pillars to the business. There was the rocket launch business, which is very stable, very predictable. It's a much bigger business now. It's very modelable, right? And in a sense that it's a bit like a private equity business. These are multi-year contracts. You know, they're with counterparties like the US government and others that have great counterparty risk, et cetera. You know, the cash flows are going to come in, but it's not necessarily the case that you're going to have 100 times more launches 1 year relative to the next, right? They grow, they execute. They're on pace to have more launches this year than they ever had before. But that's like a private equity like business where at the time we thought that was potentially like a 3x to 5x type business. Then the second pillar at that time was Starlink, which was still TBD. Right? That's a relatively unbounded TAM, right? There's over 8 billion people on the planet. All of us want great, uninterrupted internet. You know, whether you're in, the Kalahari Desert or whether you're in the hills of Los Angeles, right? There's a lot of problems with this. They publicly announced, you know, I believe that they've got, you know, over 2 million subscribers already. You know, I think 2.5 is the latest reports that are publicly out there. People paying over $1,000 a month. So you can see how you can get to billions and tens of billions, even perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars of revenue just off that business alone, right? And so at the time that SpaceX was pricing back in the kind of 2017 era, that was TBD. You know, we were launching satellites up there. There was a question about whether or not the latency would be okay. How would he get the price point down, et cetera? You know, all of which he and the team have done really well. And now you're moving on to the third pillar of it, right? Which is a little bit of, I think, the true venture area of SpaceX, which is the what if. You know, what's the TAM of the space sector? What does the space sector even mean? You have other businesses. I think we might even be co-invested in, you know, things like Varda, which are doing things which are only possible because the cost of launch and relaunch has fallen, you know, so precipitously, and it's continuing to do so with Starship, et cetera. And so there's a real right tail to SpaceX that I think really stokes the imagination, right? And you've got, you know, the greatest entrepreneur of our generation. You know, at the helm. So, but that's kind of how we saw it as a relatively predictable cash flowing business. Now you've got Starlink, which I think has moved into that category, but with a much larger market in terms of revenue. And then you have lots of other business models that can be, you know, tied onto the back of that.
So if we then go maybe from Coinbase, which is, you know, kind of crypto, and I think a lot of people would say like, hey, this seems like maybe it's going to work, maybe it's not. It's a whole new industry, but there's not really technology risk as much as like, is this an industry or not? Then you have SpaceX, which really was technology risk. People knew space existed, right? We'd gone to space before, but it was like, hey, can we do this continuously at lower cost with the reusable rockets? Then you got kind of this like middle ground, a company maybe like Stripe, where, you know, Stripe is kind of serving new use cases, new markets, but it is really kind of technology risk. I'm like, can you make the payment processor just work better and get it installed and on these websites, et cetera? And so like, how did you guys think about Stripe as a business to invest in?
Yeah, that's a great distinction. You know, I think what all three of those businesses have in common and, you know, what you're often looking for, even when you're investing at the growth or later stages of private markets versus, you know, seed stage investing and some of the, you know, the angel stages that you invest in as well is, you know, you're underwriting the business at the stages that we're investing. But at the end of the day, when you have a really one of one founder, right, when you have someone who can really move the needle, you know, it's important to factor that in as well. And I think one of the difficult things and one of the exciting things about investing in venture is that you're investing behind people where you're investing in their business as it currently stands, but you're also buying a bit of a call option. I heard somebody one time describe investing in Amazon in the early days and saying, you know, isn't it amazing that, you know, that we can get Jeff Bezos to manage money for us? You know, when you think about buying a share of stock like that, you have one of the world's best operators essentially managing your capital for you, right? I bring that up to say, you know, I think the Stripe founders are, and really the team, the quality of the team at Stripe is really noticeable, right? And I think the quality of the founders, you know, anytime you see them on a podcast, et cetera, is really extremely unique. So even though they're operating in a business which, as you say, they haven't, you know, reinvented the wheel per se, right? It's not like a rocket launch business. It's not an entirely new category. They're bringing execution and growth and, you know, and stewardship to an industry which has existed, but which has tons of room for, you know, innovation and optimization. I think what you have to think about with something like Stripe, or at least the way we've thought about it, we've been investing in the business for a few years now, is that this is also a business where, as you say, the technology risk isn't really there. People understand how large the market is. People understand how talented the founders are. And so I think what you have to do in those types of situations, at least from our perspective, is really try and disentangle a great business from a great investment. You know, sometimes you can have a great business, but if the market knows it's a great business, it's difficult for it to be a great investment because it's fully in the price, right? Whereas in when you're taking technological risk, if you have a view which is, you know, orthogonal to the market, you may be able to see around the corner or just have a belief that allows you to take certain element of risk that allows you to generate an outsized return. It's harder on a business like Stripe because Stripe's a Silicon Valley darling. Everybody knows how excellent the business is, all right? Everybody knows how excellent the founders are. And, you know, we had been investing in Stripe, but, you know, the large market pullback, you know, that we all saw in, you know, kind of 2021, when fintech businesses in the public market, Adyen and PayPal, et cetera, you know, got hit very hard when all SaaS businesses and technology multiples ratcheted down, you know, in the public markets anywhere from 40 to 80% for high quality names. That opened up an entry point, you know, for ourselves and also for other investors to combine great business with what we thought was great value, right? And I feel like, you know, that's a business which I fully expect to be running 10, 20, and 30 years into the future. And so you're discounting, you know, a future state of the world, which has much longer duration, I think, than many other businesses, which you feel like maybe more of the moment, but aren't necessarily here to stay. I think, you know, it's our expectation and a lot of others that, you know, Stripe can be a very large public company for a very long time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And really what you're talking about is like, there's almost this distortion that happened in markets, right? I think a lot of people point to zero interest rates as being maybe the one of, if not the main culprit. But also I think like, a lot of investors lost discipline. They kind of didn't care about the discipline and diligence. They just were, you know, throwing money around. And so if you see everyone else doing it, then your LPs start asking like, hey, why are you not deploying capital this quickly? Talk a little bit about, you know, kind of how these private markets have transitioned and changed over, you know, maybe like last like 4 years. There was like a moment of fear in 2020 to like exuberance back down. And now it seems like maybe we're somewhere in between.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, narratives are so powerful, right? In hindsight, it's really easy for all of us to, you know, to sit in the armchair and look back and see that ZIRP was the anomaly. But at the time, right, you know, in every country around the world, right, you know, talking about, you know, negative interest rates in most developed countries, And obviously, in hindsight, it was incredibly heady and it was incredibly distortive, you know. And I think it really played into both crypto and venture. You know, these are very long duration asset classes where you're moving out on the risk curve. And if you're essentially being taxed to have your money not at work, you know, taxed by inflation, whether or not it was showing up in the official numbers, right? Taxed because the interest rates were so low. And like you say, taxed because, you know, the assets that you weren't investing in were performing so high. It really did, you know, make a lot of sense to people, including large institutions at that time, to really push themselves out the risk curve. But it created distortions that I think we're still seeing the ramifications of today. So the way that we see it is, you know, the interest rates were incredibly low. People allocated extremely heavily to private markets, venture in particular. Revenue multiples, you know, regularly were in the high double digits and sometimes even in the triple digits, right? You know, EBITDA multiples and things like that were essentially non-existent at the time. When you had that incredible retrenchment, I think what's most surprising about it is a lot of people maybe who hadn't been around in 2008 were likening that pullback to, you know, to a bitter pill and a lesson learned and perhaps some mistakes that wouldn't be repeated again anytime soon. And you fast forward, you know, not 2 to 3 years later. And like you say, I think that now we're in a middle area, but it's very bifurcated. On the one hand, I think you have AI, which is operating in a totally different paradigm, you know, 100 times revenue multiples, $1 billion valuations on businesses which haven't generated any revenue yet, you know, funding at these kinds of, you know, peak euphoric type valuations based just on team and market opportunity on the one hand. But then you have the median company, you know, high quality businesses in the private markets that have hardly rebounded at all from that huge, you know, I'd call it say 50 to 70% sell-off that a lot of companies experienced in 2021. And so in a sense, I would say AI right now for private market GPs and private market LPs, the investors behind those funds, is sort of a tale of two cities. On the one hand, it's created a huge amount of enthusiasm and there's a potential for a lot of value creation, both for consumers, for the world at large, and for investors. But on the other hand, it's also really sucked the oxygen out of the room for lots of other businesses that don't have an up and to the right AI story. And obviously a lot of them are contorting themselves to try and, you know, to try and tell that type of a narrative. But it's very similar to what we're seeing in public markets, where if you look at the index level, you know, stocks have had a great run. But if you look one level underneath the hood, you know, you have the Mag 7, which is on a tear. And then you have the medium businesses or the small medium cap businesses in the public markets that have fared really poorly. And that's what we're seeing in venture as well. You know, there are the SpaceXs, the Stripes, the Anduril's, where the demand is as high as ever, plus, you know, all the AI companies as well. And then you have a lot of other companies, some that are high quality, some that are maybe not so much so, but none of those are necessarily getting the octane. And so if there was a venture capital index like a public market index, I think that index would be trading relatively close to the highs. But because people don't invest in venture like that, I think there's still a lot of pain, and a lot of indigestion in the private markets.
So as that happens, venture capitalists have to decide how to deploy capital into the market, right? They got to figure out when, what part of the market, what companies, when to sell, which I think actually is something that you guys have thought a lot about versus most investors who kind of just buy and hold forever. And I know you've got this theme of like the financialization of venture capital, and it feels like maybe some of these worlds are now colliding or blurring. And so talk a little bit I would put you guys as one of the pioneers of some of this stuff, but how do you think about the financialization of venture capital?
Yeah. It's a term, you know, I don't know if we came up with it ourselves. It feels like we do. It's certainly something we've been thinking about for a long time. I think a lot of it just comes from some combination of the confidence and humility to really try to play to our strengths as much as possible. You know, it's one of the few tenets of investing I feel like I've learned over my 20 plus year career is that there are many different ways to make and lose money. But the surest way to lose money is to be trying to invest in a way which isn't aligned with your personal psychology and your personal edge and your personal skill set. So a lot of venture capitalists have a product and an operating background, right? And our firm is not like that, you know, and I'm not like that. My background comes from the hedge fund side, you know, where you buy and you sell, you're highly opportunistic, you're very tactical, you know, you have fundamental, but also tactical, timing, taking profit. These kinds of things are you know, are the bread and butter of hedge fund investing. But I think that there is a different type of investor, some of whom have been very successful on the venture side, that come from a product orientation and have seen a lot of their wealth creation come from compounding and, you know, and power law returns in a couple winners. And I think that's the zeitgeist. That's the narrative that really informs most people that go into venture. We came into it without that background, you know, without that skill set, with a different skill set. And so it wouldn't make sense for us to be investing, playing somebody else's game. You know, that would be, I think, a recipe for subpar performance, right? So if we were trying to do more of what we do better, more of what we have experience in, the idea for us was, you know, was sort of simple. We thought venture as an industry, for those of us that live in it, you know, feels like a large ecosystem, but it's a very small fish in a very large pond when compared to bonds, you know, property, public market equities, you know, commodities, et cetera. And so a lot of the things which have happened, a lot of the financialization that has happened in other asset classes has yet to come to venture. You know, there's very little structure in venture. There are really no options. People think of their investments as options, but there are no options per se. There's a lot of things, you know, there's the structure of venture funds is very different than structure of hedge funds, et cetera. The idea that you need to be able to recycle and distribute cash to LPs in a relatively predictable timeframe is something which, you know, it's a conversation, the volume of which has been turned up a lot in recent years. But for the prior decade, there were very little cash distributions for many venture funds, but it didn't impede their fundraising, you know, and their ability. And obviously that's changing a lot now, which is creating a lot more interest in the secondary market and the ability to manufacture a sale prior to the company, you know, tapping the public markets. And so, so we look for areas where we think that we have a comparative advantage relative to the market. So, you know, a lot of that was secondaries in the early days of Bracket. We're focusing a lot, as you say, on this financialization and this structure now. You know, capital has a lot more leverage. Capital is a lot more expensive now than it was in the time of ZIRP, obviously. And so, you know, you're seeing term sheets with liquidation preferences, you're seeing warrants, i.e. call options being attached to deals, et cetera. You know, I think these can be weaponized, or there's a way to approach them in a partnership mentality, you know, which is what we're trying to do. But I think that the evolution of the financialization of venture, because the asset class is getting so much larger, is also bringing in people with other skill sets in addition to the kind of product-led skill sets within, you know, I think have dominated the industry thus far.
When you think of this kind of financialization, I think there's a lot of folks who obviously see the benefit to the venture investors and, you know, the LPs and the ability to drive better returns. How do you think about it in terms of the tailwind it provides for some of these companies?
Yeah, well, I think one of the biggest points of differentiation is, I would say that there's two. One is which, you know, staying private as a company can really be a luxury and a privilege. I think there's a lot of benefits to going public, and a lot of people have been speaking about this recently in terms of, you know, the increased discipline, the fitness that it requires, et cetera. And I think there's a point in time which that's helpful, but it also brings a lot of other costs and a lot of other things alongside with it. And so the ability to package your offering as a company in different ways that appeal to different types of investors may give you the flexibility to not just feel like you have a binary, which is you have to be an unprofitable, foot to the gas startup or a public company, you know, competing with the Mag 7, right? If you're able to essentially tranche, you know, there are certain investors who want very high risk, very long duration. They want, you know, they want to put a little bit of money in a seed round, wait 10 or 15 years, and they're happy with a really high failure rate. There are much larger pools of capital that don't need 100x returns, but want a much higher probability of a positive return. Those investors might be looking for 3 to 5x over 3 to 5 years. And so if you only raise money in the exact same way, you know, through priced equity rounds that are highly competitive, that only happen once every couple of years, right? Where you have a bidding war, the venture capitalist that pays the highest price, or perhaps, you know, had the biggest brand times the highest price, wins that round. That's certainly one way of doing it. It's not to say that that's going away. But there are lots of other pools of capital and lots of other investors who think about their portfolio in different ways that may want to lend to those businesses. They may want to invest off cycle on the rounds, right? It may be the case that we think company A has hit a great inflection point right now. The company may not be raising a round, right? They may not need to raise a round. They might not raise a round for 2 years, but there could be investors in from 7 or 8 years ago, or early employees who are looking for some interim term liquidity. So I think the idea for us really is, let's try and be dynamic. Let's try to invest in the companies we want to invest in when we want to invest in them. And ideally, let's even see, how do we want to invest? Do we want to have common shares because we think the public market is an inevitability? Do we want to have some more preference on top because we think that the company is going through a transition and we need to protect our investors with some downside protection? I think that the opportunity, we don't do this currently, but you know, to lend to these businesses, that market's growing. There are a lot of businesses, as you well know, we've talked about this, raising equity. They might want to finance themselves in a more effective way with debt or with some sort of hybrid structure. So we're trying to be disciplined in looking for those types of setups that really appeal to us and play to our strengths. But we're trying to be open-minded and not feel like we have to fund these businesses or access these businesses in the exact same ways at the exact same times that has become so common in the industry.
When you see these, are there certain types of businesses, whether stage or sector, that really lends itself more so? Like, obviously, if there's a founder building a fintech company, right, who comes off Wall Street, like, they just may be more receptive and understanding. I think a lot of times, whenever we've looked in like the industrial or manufacturing sector, one of the hardest parts is if you're doing a deal where you do a lot of deals, but the counterparty, this is the first and only deal they're going to do in their life. Sometimes you literally start with like, you know, what's a board of directors? Right. And like, it's really hard to get deals done because you're just, there's an information gap there that's hard to overcome. So I think like one, there's probably like some, hey, you deal with people who are founders who have a similar background and they understand structure and they understand some of this stuff. But are there sectors or other trends and kind of similarities that you see where you guys are trying to pick up or maybe look for deals?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. That can be, you know, that can be an impediment. And I think that's one of the areas where, where I think if you bring too much structure or too much complexity to the deal, you know, the company, the employees that are on the other side of it, you know, are, they may not be financial experts, but they're very talented in their own sphere. And they, like we know enough to know when you're on the wrong side of the table with somebody and you don't fully understand the situation as well as they do, you can find yourself, you know, in a difficult situation, right? So I think that the sweet spot, to your point, is really also having a certain EQ or a certain ability to translate to say, look, what are we both trying to achieve here, right? We both want this company to be worth a lot more tomorrow than it is today, right? You may have an interim liquidity need, right? There are a variety of different ways to solve that, right? We have to be able to explain that in a way which is relatively straightforward to ourselves and to them. We don't want to over-optimize for these things. But I think honestly, coming to the table with an idea that there's a win-win solution to create here, a positive sum solution, that's something that venture-backed businesses fundamentally understand, right? Because it is a really positive sum mindset versus the kind of typical Wall Street, perhaps credit mentality where, you know, the pie is a certain size, it's a bilateral transaction, there definitionally is going to be a winner and a loser on this transaction. I think one of the things which is so nice about being in this space, this sort of venture California mentality, is that the idea is for the pie to expand, right? And people have seen that pie expand many, many, many times, right? Whether to your point, whether they've gone through it themselves or not, you know, we live in LA, is kind of liken it to the idea similar to Hollywood here, right? You know, many parts of the world, if your waiter or your waitress said they want to be a movie star, you know, it can be greeted with a certain level of skepticism, right? In LA, it doesn't mean the odds are necessarily high, but it's happened enough times, right, that you can't dismiss it outright. Similarly, startups in garages have happened enough times for people that have lived in that ecosystem, let alone work in that ecosystem, that really being a pessimist is a sort of an irrational point of view, right? Being a skeptic, what do they say, you know, like bulls get rich and, you know, bears get published or something like that, right? You know, it can be intellectually satisfying to be skeptical of all things, but you really have to have a pretty strong reality distortion field to live in California and not believe that a team of hardworking, smart people can create something much bigger tomorrow than exists today. And so I think we try to just come at it with the perspective of, you know, the solution we're aiming at here is a relatively simple one where you get what you need now and our investors get what they need tomorrow, right? And for us, tomorrow is 3 to 5 years away as opposed to 10 to 15 years away. But like I said, there are opportunities to do that. And to your point, within sectors, I think this is where some of the interesting opportunity is. You know, I think not to say that any one area is more interesting than the other, but to say the more eyeballs that are on a given sector, be that AI or SaaS businesses over the last few years, definitionally, the opportunity set there is going to be more competitive, less unique, right? You're going to have less opportunity to differentiate in terms of returns with your competitive set. If you're looking at manufacturing or businesses which are helping reindustrialization, you'd be thinking about Hadrian or a business like that. There are lots of other businesses where this energy is not focused. And you know, by definition, I think it makes a lot more sense to be spending more of your time there than in the former.
Yeah, one of the things that you and I have not talked about that I know that you guys did that would be interesting maybe to kind of break down is when people hear a crossover investor, they historically have thought about public market hedge funds who are crossing over to invest in the private market. And the story has been, we as public market investors can gain information, right, by investing in the private market that can help our public book, and vice versa, we may understand certain things about valuation or businesses and trends for the public market that then can help inform private market investing. You all, though, have done at least one deal that I know of where, as a private market investor, you've crossed over to invest in the public market, but still did it via like a private deal. So maybe talk a little bit as to like almost the reverse of the crossover investing that people are used to hearing about.
So, you know, this was a recent investment. It was a 2023 investment out of our latest fund. To be honest, when we raised the fund, it wasn't something that we had specifically contemplated, you know? But what we always contemplate is that the market's dynamic, things are shifting very quickly now. And when things shift, opportunities present themselves that may not have existed yesterday. And so you have to have, you know, sort of an open mind, and your antenna up. What we saw, you know, and this opportunity came from that is we were involved in a few businesses on the private side that had SPAC'd, you know, in the sort of peak of the market. Most SPACs, after a certain amount of time, performed relatively poorly, right? Some of them have gone on to do well, businesses like SoFi, et cetera, that we were invested in. But a lot of the SPAC market, certainly at that trough in the kind of 2021 sell-off, many of them were down trading at around $1 a share. And when SPACs issue, they tend to trade at $10. Some of them have traded up as high as $20 or $30. Many of them had come all the way back down to $1 or $2 a share. And we were discussing on the team here, you know, we like dislocated opportunities. Many of the private companies we invest in are already as large or larger than their public market counterparts, right? So we don't see a huge distinction between a public company and a private company. Both of them are equity. Both of them are companies from our perspective. We began to develop a thesis that, you know, many of these SPACs were probably not going to make it, right? Many of the ones that were at $1 a share may very well end up being worth zero. But the ones that weren't going to zero were also all being priced at essentially the exact same level as the ones that were worth zero. So I think, once again, if you looked at an index, perhaps you could argue that the SPAC index was fairly valued. But within that, there was a lot of bifurcation. A lot of those companies should be worth zero, and a small number of those companies should probably be worth $5 to $10, right? So we thought there was 5 to 10x upside on a variety of these businesses that were largely being painted with the same brush, right? And when you're a small cap company or a post-SPAC company, the market cap is not that high. The research coverage isn't that high. The market doesn't really know and understand you. So I think it takes a lot of hubris to look at a very well-covered public company, large public company with millions of eyeballs on it, many billions of dollars of capital, finding efficiency in the price. You know, finding a true inefficiency on that kind of a stock is very difficult. You may be right or wrong about it being worth more or less tomorrow, but there's a lot of efficiency, right? The markets are very smart and capital is very fast and very smart. It was intriguing to us that a lot of these, you know, post-SPAC names were trading single digit millions of dollars in volume, you know, maybe a couple million dollars a day. Large hedge funds were not in it, correcting any price discrepancies. Wall Street wasn't covering the names because there weren't enough people that wanted to, you know, to read the research and look into it. And so by definition, we thought that there would be dislocations there. In the case of the company you were talking about, you know, we ended up leading a private investment round into that business. They needed a bit more capital, much like a private company did. And so instead of just buying common stock, we did a what's called a pipe, but different than a SPAC pipe, you know, just a private investment into a public equity. We led that round and it worked out very well for us, you know, over the next kind of, you know, 12 to 18 months. That company re-rated relatively aggressively. But those are the kinds of anomalies that we do find intriguing, and we want to, you know, we want to have a loose enough grip, you know, I would say, to make sure that when another dislocation comes up, you know, it could be ZERP, it could be SPACs, you know, the next one is around the corner, TBD, what that will be. But we want to stay open-minded. And like I said, you know, we're trying to find great investments alongside great companies, and great investments often come from some sort of dislocation in the market, right? And so we want to be reactive to those when we see them.
When you're evaluating these types of things, are there aspects of the public markets that actually make it more attractive? Like, you know, liquidity being kind of maybe like the most obvious thing, but you know, is there just like a blending over time, and anybody who gets a decent size in terms of AUM in a single fund and has the ability to make these evaluations, like they tend to gravitate towards public markets. I think about in the early stages, a lot of investors have started to gravitate towards crypto because they're just getting liquidity faster. And you know, one of the maybe lessons learned over the last decade or so investing in these private companies is like, man, these things stay private way longer than a lot of us thought they were going to.
That's right.
If you look at, you know, I went back and I looked at, I think it was since 2013, maybe, QQQ has averaged somewhere in the ballpark of like 13%. Not bad. The average venture fund they claim is about 17%. So if you take those numbers face value, 400 basis points of outperformance, but you're illiquid for, you know, a decade plus, depending on who you are, maybe it's worth it, maybe it's not, right? It's like, how do you think about liquidity and kind of allocating capital?
You know, I think this liquidity question is a really interesting one. I'm actually curious to get your perspective on it as well, because I laughingly, or I sort of jokingly said a few years ago to some members of the team, I suspect that it would actually probably be worth it for people to invest in a closed-end crypto fund, let's say, you know, say before the last sell-off, where you locked up your money for 10 years, and you were just paying somebody, even though you could buy it liquidly, with no transaction costs. Maybe it was worth it just to outsmart your own personal psychology to make sure that you don't sell into the next bear market, This total idea is a great one if you can do it. And I sort of feel the same way about venture. And it's a slightly tongue-in-cheek analysis, but I actually wonder, you know, I think in venture, some of these great returns have come from these very unusual power law outcomes, You invested in a business at five pre, it goes on to be worth 10 or 20 or 30 or $40 billion, In the public markets, it's very difficult to hold an investment for that long, Because in hindsight, the charts look up and to the right. But as you know, from crypto, you know, there's 20 to 30% drawdowns like we're seeing right now, frequently along the way up, And so I think liquidity is valuable if you have a mental psychology that allows you to trade around a core position, i.e. buying when there's fear and selling, you know, when there's optimism. But if your psychology is programmed like the majority of investors, and certainly the majority of non-professionalized investors, then you're going to be twisting yourselves into knots because you're going to be over-leveraged, selling into the lows, and then scrambling back up to buy higher with FOMO. So I guess the question is, on the face of it, I would say, to your point, assuming those venture returns are accurate, you know, and they could very well be inflated and they're very much on paper, I think it's hard to argue that 400 basis points for your average investor for a total lack of liquidity, that seems like a small premium. Seems like you would want much higher return than that. I guess the question is, how many people in accounts outside of their retirement account, can hold the NASDAQ and create that 13% compounded return throughout all those, you know, kind of peaks and valleys, And so, One of the questions I have, you know, as someone and as a firm who spends a lot of time in the secondary market and feels like we're relatively, you know, in touch with what's happening there, is that the market wants liquidity and demands liquidity, and liquidity is coming. Secondary market and venture is coming, It's getting larger and larger. It will happen. It's not clear to me. I would actually probably take the other side of the bet. I suspect venture returns and early stage venture returns in particular will probably decrease dramatically as liquidity comes online, because in an, as an early stage manager, you know, it's your one winner that's paying for your nine losers, and that winner really needs to outperform and power law. And, you know, whether it's in crypto or whether it's in public market investing, It takes a special kind of investor to be able to hold a position that long. It's one of Berkshire's great sources of edge, right? Is not just their stock selection, but that they're playing at a different duration than the rest of the market, right? And I think you can play much shorter, i.e. Citadel, right? Or Millennium, right? Or you can play much larger, i.e. Berkshire. Playing in the middle is tricky, right? And it can be painful. So I think that the liquidity is coming, and we're certainly investing in and around that theme. But I think it's going to be much harder for people to hold their winners. I think they're going to realize that the illiquidity was perhaps a feature of private market investing as opposed to a bug.
Yeah. What's interesting about this is when you see the Bitcoin holder base and 70% hasn't sold, has it gone up and down, all this stuff, yeah, and everything. Yeah. I can't think of another asset that has anywhere near the volatility where people are holding. And if you really think about one of the major drivers is just the story, right? Yeah. It's like, hey, it's going to be worth way more in the future. And so many people believe it, yeah, all this stuff. Yeah. That's really hard to do in private tech companies because competition, yeah, is kind of like the default state. Yeah. And there's always somebody who shows up to the dance and you're like, oh, they may be better.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. The disruption risk is really high there. I mean, I even feel the same way, with Bitcoin. When you show those types of stats, to me, that's one of the most bullish narratives, mm-hmm, about Bitcoin in particular, right? Is that I suspect there is no other asset class like that, perhaps except real estate. People aren't, mm-hmm. Well, if real estate was incredibly liquid, people probably losing a lot more money on that as opposed to it being, probably the single greatest wealth generator, I would imagine over long periods of time in the country. And I feel that way about Bitcoin as well, right? I think if you've been in it long enough and you've been sensitized to it, what we've all done is you found a position size, which makes sense for you, right? And that position size, at least in my world, is usually one where when it's really ripping to the upside, you're a little bit sad that you don't have more, right? And when it's selling off to the downside, you're slightly concerned, but not overly so, and not enough to parachute out of it, right? And so, I watch the Bitcoin price very infrequently, right? If it drops 20% today, there's a 0%, 0% chance I would sell any, and I'm probably in, a large company. I don't know how many other companies or asset classes or markets in the world where people are operating essentially without a stop loss, right? I think there's probably a very large portion that would ride Bitcoin, up to 500K or down to a dollar and be buying at that dollar, right? Which is why it would never get there, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't have
I do think that's one of the interesting things is it'll never drop below some number, whether it's a dollar or 10,000, whatever, because it's just there are too many people trying to buy it, right?
You wouldn't sell it there, right? You just wouldn't.
Yeah. And also you just seen it drop so many times, 80%, yeah, what's the difference between 80 and 90? It's kind of it went down a lot. One other aspect of this too, that I think about when we talk about kind of public and private and these structured deals, et cetera, is when you have liquidity, access is default. If I want to go buy Bitcoin today, I don't need to call up a founder. I don't need to do it. All the information is available to me to evaluate it. Yeah. And then I can go onto an exchange or hit, an OTC desk or something, and I can just buy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I want to invest in whatever you and I deem is, a great private company, it's not that easy.
No.
And so how do you think about kind of access and public and private opportunities? And then also access versus maybe analytical, decision-making, how many of the deals are just hey, I have access, other people don't, that's, alpha, versus this is a good company to actually invest in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great question. It's a key question. And I think it has two sides to the argument, sort of like the liquidity one. On the one hand, it's certainly a strong benefit to insiders, to those of us who are in touch with those founders, who can access that type of capital. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion around whether that's unfair, accredited versus non-accredited investors, et cetera. I don't know too many other markets that I feel like operate in a way where access is so crucial. Perhaps something like the fine art market or something like that, right? Where even if you have the money, you may just not know where to source that artist, you may not be invited into that sort of members club, et cetera. So in venture, certainly access is incredibly important. I think, from our perspective, from my perspective, I like to sort of question these assumptions and these unspoken premises. I think that the premise that a lot of people operate under is that If you had access to every private company in the world, right, that investing would be easy, right? That the impediment to returns is literally just access, right? And I think what public market investing shows you, which is a much more competitive arena even than private market investing, you know, which is also very competitive, right? But you've got the Stan Druckenmillers of the world, et cetera, you know, competing against you to some extent, right, in the public markets, because every time a large investor does something, it moves the price, right? So there is so much intelligence and so much information in every price that it's not an obvious decision whether you're supposed to go buy NVIDIA or sell NVIDIA or buy Facebook or sell Facebook, right? These companies are often priced in a way, right? I mean, this is how supply and demand works, that it's not obvious. I think from an armchair perspective, people could look on the outside and say, well, private markets aren't like that, right? I would just buy Stripe and Anduril and SpaceX and OpenAI or, you know, or whatever the names are. But private markets are much too efficient even for that to be true, right? So certainly you'd rather have the access than not have it, obviously, right? But even with the access, I think what's been undervalued, and maybe this is the point, less than access being overvalued, is that I think analysis on the private market side is probably undervalued. Even when you talk to investors, you know, a lot of the discussion is around how you source, right? A lot of it is around how you get access to these businesses, which is important. But, you know, the hedge fund industry is many multiples larger, right, than the venture capital industry. And everyone has access to that. And it's incredibly difficult to generate even a 10% return on the hedge fund side, right? And so I think that we try and balance that scale a little bit. We spend a lot of time trying to have access, also looking for unique opportunities where things are not as fully valued. But certainly, you know, end of the day, investing is a picking business, right? It's an analysis business, and the price you pay, I mean, it sounds very obvious, but within venture, it's not exactly the mindset many people have. You know, the price you pay is incredibly important and directly related to the outcome, right? I mean, it's the simple, most obvious, you know, mundane comment, but there is oftentimes a feeling in venture where people feel like any price I pay for this business, because the business is great, and that could be a great business, but it may not be a great investment.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And it also is just a reminder, like, investing is hard. Right. It's supposed to be hard. And when everything just kind of goes up, whether it's venture capital, public markets, crypto, you know, real estate, anything, when everything's just going up and you just kind of throw money in and, you know, it doubles, it doesn't feel so hard. And like, maybe actually a big lesson over the last 4 years is like, be very weary when things seem easy.
Absolutely. It's a warning sign, right? It's a warning sign. You start to feel like things are easy. It's certainly a warning sign.
Yeah. Where can we send people to find out more about Bracket or follow you if they'd want to get more information?
Yeah. You know, we don't have a big social media presence. We have a website, you know, bracketcapital.com. You know, we're on Twitter, JBL@bracketcapital.com. You know, mainly there, you know, researching information as opposed to commenting and producing content, something, you know, I and we should probably do a little bit more of in the future. You know, occasionally on some of these podcasts on CNBC and stuff like that, but generally keeping a pretty low profile.
I know you are. I'm going to convince you not to do that anymore. Share all your insight with everybody. All right. Well, I appreciate it very much. I learned today, which is always the goal, and I think other people did too. And we'll definitely do it again in the future.
Yeah. Thanks, Pomp. Appreciate you.